The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hi, Don the Stat listeners. Ian here with another episode. My podcast partner, Jonathan's overseas at the moment for work, but we wanted to make sure that we cover the appointment that Brad Scott is the new Essendon coach. So with that in mind, I approached someone I thought could give us a different insight into Scott as coach. He's someone who's worked at North Melbourne for many years through the Brad Scott years and has developed into one of the most insightful game analysts online. Ricky Mangitis, welcome to Don the Stat.
Thanks for having me. I think it might be my last appearance as part of the North Melbourne community. They'll disown me once they've found out I'm on an Essendon podcast. But until then, I'm going to enjoy our chat.
Well, that's all right. Well, you know, I'll give you the opportunity to get stuck into us, and that might give you some cred because you have the honour of being the first non-Essendon supporter who's joined Don the Stat. In terms of like your online presence, you're someone I've been, you know, you pop up in the feed every now and then, but I think it was your analysis of the last play of the Essendon Collingwood after the siren result that really made me sit up and take notice and take a closer look at your work, which is top notch. You know, there's a real gap in an analysis, you know, when we look at some of the stuff that's happening in the media. So having someone of your quality doing the work you're doing is excellent for fans. So for those who aren't familiar with you, can you give a bit of a background on who you are, what your connection to North is, and what was your role at the club when you worked there?
Yeah, sure. So I guess the main reason I'm on here is because I used to work at North as part of the media crew for 6 years between 2012 and 2017, which was the relative glory years under Brad Scott, basically running the socials. And then a lot of writing for the website as well. So I probably should be open off the top and say that I'm always going to have a bit of a bias towards Brad, because without him and most of the coaches that were in North while I was there, I wouldn't know, 80-90% what I know now about football. Because when you're in that job and you're out on the track, you know, taking photos of training or doing interviews or just observing, like if you want to, you're also learning at the same time about game styles and how coaches operate, what it takes, and basically you have free access to them. And if they're willing, which Brad and co were, they were, you know, more than willing to teach me about all these things that I've then taken forward. And then after I left North, I had all this knowledge and I was like, geez, I want to put it to good news somewhere. I feel like I've been in a privileged position and got access to things that that not many people do. So fired up a blog at theshinboner.com, started it as North stuff, and then got the itch to sort of branch out to league-wide stuff as well. I guess the name, the Shinboner, probably doesn't help me there, does it? But I like to think there's some kind of brand recognition that I don't necessarily want to get rid of. So I kept the name and doing North stuff and league-wide stuff, and here we are.
Yeah, I mean, you're doing some really good work with the trade feedback and you know what it means to the clubs. You know, I've read your Carl Amon piece just before, and yeah, just like the depth of analysis there and what he brings to that club. You know, I think we probably hate Hawthorn, so at least that's some common ground there. But the fact that you could look at that dispassionately and, you know, really dig down into why they would want him, hopefully when Essendon gets someone in, you know, if anyone wants to come to the club in a club in disarray, you know, hopefully we get the same depth of analysis there. But I guess, you know, just going into the sort of the North Essendon relationship, I think when we played the North game earlier in the season, we asked the question, is the Essendon North rivalry a real one? Because I think that's particularly with Essendon supporters, it's a bit of a strong opinion that it's, for a lot of them, that it's not. What's your take on Essendon and North as rivals, and what are the things that stand out to you in that rivalry?
I mean, I think maybe I'm out of touch, but I feel like from the Essendon point of view, North, they probably look at North as that annoying little brother that won't shut up to an extent. I know from the North point of view, though, Essendon is the main rivalry. I mean, it's to be as blunt as that. I mean, it goes back, you know, decades, generations. I mean, literally 100 years ago, dating back to when North initially wanted to enter the AFL, as it was then. So Yeah, from a North point of view, that Essendon rivalry is number one, which is why you still see everyone online go on and on about the elimination final in 2014, even though I think North only beat Essendon once since then, maybe twice. Yeah,
I think the last one was in 2016 with the top-ups.
That's right, yeah. And then even that was only 10 points or whatever, because all the top-ups, they went kick the last few goals, didn't they? Remember, that was the game that
Essendon didn't get a goal at half-time or something like that, and then... You know, I think North stopped, and then you know Essendon got close, and everyone was really happy with the effort because of the way that year played out. But yeah, I think that's the last time. And then obviously recent results for us, I think the Tipper game stands out. I remember sitting behind. I was pretty much in line with that goal, and you're just going nuts, and then rushing to the AFL app to check how long was left to see if there was enough time. I think we'll probably bring up the 2014 elimination final a bit later because we'll talk about. Brad Scott and finals, but I guess just in terms of origins and your understanding of Essendon North, what are the matches that stand out for you going back prior to your time with North Melbourne?
I mean, for me, I was in sort of primary school late 90s, early 2000s, and when North and Essendon were the two best teams for that period. You know, you can make the case that sort of 99 should have been Essendon's premiership, and then, but you know, obviously not to rub salt in the wound, that didn't happen. And then obviously there was 2000, and some of those games I just remember as a 8, 9, 10, 11 year old heading to 2001, and that famous comeback game. But that was kind of the sort of the top layer and the pinnacle of what you wanted to watch growing up. I remember, you know, in the schoolyard, everyone's like, oh, yeah, North Essendon this week, it's going to be awesome. And that was huge. I mean, here's something I don't think I've told many people. That comeback game on 2001, so I was 11, and I was, you know, Dad was a Collingwood supporter. He used to drag me along to North games and like, hey, I really want to go North Essendon. He's like, no, no, no. And then eventually managed to persuade him, and it was late. And, you know, we got in the car and went to the MCG, and we literally sat down as North went 11 goals up. So I actually missed all the good stuff. And as soon as we sat down, the comeback started. So I kind of blame myself for that.
Well, my story of that is that I went to that game. It was only ever the second game I ever went to. The first game I ever went to was actually, if you remember back to that 2000 year for Essendon where they only lost one game, that was the first game I ever went to as a Essendon fan. So good choice by me. But the second game was that comeback game. And then at that point when you're sitting down, I'm begging mum to leave. I'm like, this is the worst thing ever. I'm like the Essendon jinx. Luckily, she made me stick around and got to see that. So that's a good thing. Well, I guess, yeah. So let's get into what I brought you in. Obviously, the appointment of Brad Scott as Essendon coach. I think, you know, when Barham, you know, after the sort of the first disastrous interviews and, you know, the sacking of Rutten, which I think we can all agree was handled dreadfully and probably, you know, reflects a bit of what's happening in the club at the moment. You know, Brad Scott really sort of lined up with that resume that Barham outlined at his first press conference, that of an experienced coach. And it did seem like there was a lot of push from people within the media that Brad Scott was, you know, if he wanted the job, he would be the person to get it. I know that at first I was a bit nonplussed and, you know, I wasn't upset that it was Brad Scott who got the job, but also wasn't super excited. But, you know, the more I've heard him speak and the more I've heard others speak about him, and, you know, even just hearing about his role at the AFL these past 3 years, you know, I think it's actually has started to make me a bit more excited about what he possibly could bring to the club. So I guess as someone who's observed him quite closely, what do you think the strengths of Brad Scott as an AFL coach are?
I think you mentioned one of them just there. I think judging by the reaction to his introductory presser, he's very good, very professional communicator. He leaves no doubt as to what he wants, whether that's for better or worse. Like he's always going to defend his players in public, like every single time. Like we go back to when he was North coach, when he was fined, I think it was 30,000 or 25,000 for it when he accused umpires of judging Lindsay Thomas differently. But like from his point of view, like that's what he'll do every single time. So that defending his players in public is should in theory foster a strong sense of loyalty among the group, which in turn then leads to, you know, stronger buy-in and they're more likely to carry out what Brad's asking of the playing group. And I'd say in terms of like an X's and O's point of view, based on his time at North, he's probably an offensive focus coach. It's not to say he neglects the defensive side of things at all, but purely based off his North tenure. I think the best times are off the back of a high-powered offense. And then the intangible strength that we have to wait and see is that he spent 3 years the AFL, and he's got the IP. Most other coaches, they don't probably put their head on the pillow at night and just, so I wish I could get access to what Brad was getting access to every day with his game analysis, and how he puts that to use is going to be really interesting. And then the second intangible of that is, I mean, I can only imagine what the AFL politics is like at the very top end of the organization. And he would have had to deal with that day in, day out for 3 years. So, from the outside, it looks like Essendon is a political beast as well. But he's going to come into that well-equipped to deal with it because of what he's learned in the upper echelons of the AFL. So, I mean, you can combine his communication skills with his status, and then I think because of what he's learned in his time off, time at the AFL, you combine that all, and I think he's going to come into Essendon a much better coach than he left North Melbourne.
Yeah, and is he someone you feel was able to evolve over time? Obviously, I think the fact that you suggest he's an offensively minded coach sort of, lines up with what Essendon, the good parts of Essendon have been over the past few years, good offensively. Is he the sort of person that is going to be able to, adjust to what the list needs in order to improve in your mind? Do you think he'll look at that and go, right, this is an offensively tailored list potentially, but we need to address these other issues if we're going to be successful?
I think so, yeah. Because, from a North point of view, I kind of look at 2012 to sort of 2016, first half of 2016 is, I guess, the peak period. And, and you look at 2012 as a game start, it was just like full-blown attack all the time, like what is defense type of thing. 2013 was kind of the same thing, but teams were awake to it, which led to all those, close losses. And then the sort of 2014, 2015 was, added extra defensive layers. And you could see that evolution mixed with the offense. And then that first half of 2016 was probably the peak. Then injuries hit, and there wasn't the depth behind that best sort of 25 to 26 to continue on, which was probably the first evidence of some drafting failures, which were going to hinder him the next couple of years. And to be honest, that North are only sort of just slowly coming out of now. And then his last year, it was an attempt at probably what was on paper was really ambitious attacking philosophy, lots of handball, lots of run, a high skill plan that probably a little bit ahead of its time, I think, to be honest. But the issue was that the list wasn't cut out to execute that. It was a matter of sort of square peg, round hole to an extent. And I think that's going to be what he learns from, what he has learned from. And given what he said at his presser and all the noise about, taking your time, I think by the time sort of we get to this stage next year, I think that there'll be a really clear, a clear decision of, okay, this is how we want to go. I feel like 2023 for Brad's probably going to be sort of just assessing things and seeing where they want to go.
Yeah, I think that's a fair call. And I guess, what in terms of working as part of a team, how does he go with his assistant coaches? Is he someone who likes to delegate and leave things up to the assistants, or does he want to be pretty hands-on with all aspects of it?
A bit of both. It changed a lot sort of, sometimes you'd see him out there taking everything, and sometimes it would be the assistants. There probably wasn't a real, this is how it's done, either way, one way or the other, from him, to be honest. It was very much, I guess, a situation. Sometimes the assistants take it, sometimes he would. I'm not sure if he's finalized his coaching group for next year yet, but I think a lot of it will depend on, I guess, the experience he has around him, whether it's, the same assistants or new ones and how senior they are. So I think the quality and the caliber of the assistants will dictate how he starts off with, at least.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. Obviously, Carosella is still there and is still contracted, at least for next year, as far as I know. And They obviously played in the Premiership together.
That's right, yeah.
Carosella is obviously really highly rated assistant, worked with Brad, helped Chris with the 2011 Geelong Premiership. So you would hope that they could work together in that. And yeah, and I guess, he hasn't really, what was suggested with Clarkson going into North Melbourne, that he was going to bring his whole team in at this stage. I think, as you sort of say, he's going to take stock of what he's got and then maybe make some calls at the end of 2023, both in terms of playing list and in terms of coaching lists.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Premiership teammates, right? And, I mean, unless you're I mean, maybe half the team couldn't stand Akamanis by the end, but they, from the outside, it looked like they all got on pretty well when they were winning flags. So, I think it'd be really interesting how he approaches that first year, because with all the, you know, with what Sheedy said about Hurd and all the prominent Essendon people in the media, he definitely needs time. No, I hope he gets it.
I've actually just looked it up. Brad missed the premiership that Carousel played in. So there you go. So I think they're at the club at the same time. And I think that's sort of, you know,
close
it's close enough. Yeah. I'll edit this out. No, I won't. I guess just sort of moving on. One of the things that Essendon fans have often had a real frustration with is, you know, the recent coaches, so Rutten and Worsfold, have really been focused on playing their own way and sort of ignoring the opposition. We did see a little bit of Rutten going with run roof roles in terms of Caldwell. We saw Caldwell go to Neil and be really effective, but, you know, obviously that's been a really small part of how Essendon has tried to play. Is Brad's got the sort of coach who'll really work to adjust what his team's going to do considering the opponent? Is he more focused on let's play our way and, you know, win that way?
Well, I actually think his best times as a coach at North came when he did adjust. And we look at, Ben Jacobs as a tagger actually started initially when he was, had some time off to recuperate from back surgery. And then when he came back from that, he sort of tweaked Jacobs' role. And then going here into the 2015 finals, Sam Gibson was kind of that outside winger, but then he gave him more of a defensive role in that final series, shut down Ellis against Richmond, Jeddah against Sydney, and then played on, I think, off the top of my head, Gaff against West Coast. And that back half of 2015, I think, was actually his best coaching period. And that came from the flexibility and specific matchups and tweaks and how the forwards worked a little bit as a decoy. And, I mean, that 2015 final against Richmond, obviously, it was Petrie working more as a decoy because they knew Waite had the matchup they wanted to exploit, that type of thing. So his best times came when he adjusted. There were also times that he was probably a little too slow to adjust. And whether, you know, which side of that he takes into Essendon, I'd like to think that he looks at the best times and goes, okay, I need to adjust. And especially with such a young list that Essendon have, I think if he came in and said, oh, this is the way we're doing it and put the foot down straight away, it's probably unrealistic with the way the list has to just evolve in maturity.
Yeah, and as you say, it's probably a different demographic list to what he had at North Melbourne, and you would hope that, you know, 3 years out of coaching and the perspective he's gained from viewing all the other programs through his role at the AFL, that he may really be able to come in with an open mind and adjust based on what he's got access to. But I guess I think the general perception of North Melbourne at that time is that they overachieved and Brad Scott, you know, overachieved with that list, particularly with the 2014 and 2015 prelim finals from the bottom half of the eight. Do you think that's a fair assessment? And what do you think was the key to those finals runs where, you know, North arguably overperformed based on their ladder position from that year?
It's funny because I think if you lined up any two random North fans on the street and asked them that question, one would agree, the other would disagree. You could leave them there, come back 5 hours later, and they'd probably still be arguing the point, to be honest. It's a really interesting one. Those 2012 to 2016 years, it was elimination final 2012. 2013 was probably the best football of the lot, but just, I think, missed finals and by only losing, I think, two games over 15 points all year. Obviously, then 2014, 2015 was the key years, and then 2016 started so well before it all sort of fell off a cliff. I think in those 2012, 2016 years, with the exception of the second half of 2015, like we talked about just before, there was always a general sense that there was something a little bit missing with the way North set up. I mean, amongst the fans, like the trend of certain losses, it was became something of a punchline with the giving up leads and amongst the, I guess, the section of the fans that never really bought into Brad, they were sort of out for his lack of adaptability. And I mean the close game record was just like beyond laughable. It was, so between 2012 and 2017, I did my research, so came prepared with this stat. So games decided by single figures, 8 wins, 18 losses.
Oof.
And I know that, you know, all the stats and suggest that close games are a coin flip over the long run, but the fact that it was, you know, you're looking at a 6-year period, it was 8 and 18, suggests that it went past a long streak of luck. So, I mean, I think in a sense that speaks to coaching a little bit. And then, but then, like, if those close losses turned into wins, you probably got a couple more top four finishes, and then all of a sudden people are saying, oh, they finished top four twice. And, yeah. And then they should have made at least one grand final. So it's, I think you could argue either way for hours and probably not come to a proper conclusion. There'll be a section of North fans that say, she should have done more, not necessarily in the 2014, 2015, but the other years, either side of that. And then there'll be a section to think, oh, he's definitely overachieved. So, yeah, I mean, you ask me tomorrow, I'll probably say he's overachieved. You ask me the day after that, I'll say, oh, I would have preferred a better year in sort of in 2013 and finished off better in 2016. So, yeah, it's definitely a fence sitter for me.
Yeah. And I guess if we drill down into those finals then, you know, so obviously for Essendon fans, it's the 2014 elimination final, and, you know, I think Essendon were comfortably up at halftime and North stage a comeback there, and, you know, that Frank the Tank Drew Petrie gift is just sort of embedded in my mind. It fills me with rage seeing it. So, you know, if you ever want to roll me up post that, you know, I'll lose it. I guess maybe firstly just that game, was there any way in which he specifically turned the course of that game with his coaching? Was it more just the all the work that had led up to that point allowed the North players to be confident that they could come back in that situation?
Yeah, I think it was probably the work up to that. I mean, I'm not spilling any state secrets here, but I remember at halftime looking at the way things were going, and I mean, North still had their fair share of time in the fourth half. They just weren't scoring. They'd always been a good scoring team, and you thought, well, they're just going to move it a touch quicker and get some more value for those. For those entries, and they'll have some luck, whether that ends up being a win. And one of my great regrets was that I didn't find a way to tweet something like that from North account, because I would have been dining out on that to this day. But yeah, and then the players afterwards in the rooms thought the same as well, in terms of like a single game perspective. I remember chatting to a few of them and thought, you know, they were doing a lot of good things. It just wasn't being reflected on the scoreboard. And that was, I guess, a reflection of the way North played in those times. They can give up big runs, but they could also go on big runs as well. But I think that 2015 journey speaks to why I think Brad will be a better coach at Essendon. I think I mentioned before, like in the middle part of the season, he was away for about a month to fix a pretty bad back injury. He was in a lot of pain every day. And then when he came back from that month off, he was really open to tweaks. And it was very clear both how he wanted North to play and then how he wanted to fix things when things weren't going well. And I think we're pretty middling record by the time we came back, and then went on a winning streak, and obviously beat Richmond in the elimination final, comfortably beat Sydney, and were sort of four goals up early in the second against West Coast before everything sort of stopped. I mean, that year Hawthorn were probably going to destroy whoever they played in the grand final, but yeah, that 2015, I think he'll take a lot out of that, or has taken a lot out of that. And he'll be better for it. I mean, those last sort of 3 years he was there, that general sort of list strategy became really, really muddled and confused. And that's what sort of spoke to that sort of middle treading water period they had. But yeah, I think that 2015 ones, he'll take a lot out of it. He'll be a better coach for it.
Well, it's interesting you talk about that list management strategy, because one of the first things that he came out and said with Essendon about their list strategy is trying to bring in elite talent. And I guess that was the problem that the North was having. They weren't able to get that elite talent in either through the draft, because they weren't finishing, low down the ladder to get those draft picks. And they just, you know, they couldn't quite get those, you know, those high profile players across the line. You know, I think Dustin Martin was reasonably close. I think that was the sort of the talk of the time. That
extremely close, yeah.
Extremely close. You know, I think Jordan Dugowie the first time. That's probably a bullet dodged. Let's be honest. But yeah, I guess, you know, so just moving on from there, we've talked a lot about what his strengths are as a coach. What do you think the weaknesses of him as a coach? I guess it's obviously hard to say he's bad at this and he's bad at that. I guess, yep. What are the things, the areas that he would be looking at himself and going, I need to improve on this?
I think, funnily enough, because he obviously has a lot of similarities to Chris and their personality traits. I think we can take a lot out of how Chris has adapted at Geelong. And obviously he's got a hell of a lot more resources and a lot more inbuilt advantages at Geelong than Brad ever did at North. But I mean, that strong communication can lead to a bit of stubbornness at times, and that lack of flexibility. I don't think I'm speaking out of turn to say that stubbornness can be a character trait in the Scott family, for better or worse.
Can't imagine many people were backing down at Christmas over the last piece of ham or something like that.
I don't know what the backyard career games would be like, I'll tell you that.
there wouldn't be much pitch in the batsman's half, I imagine.
No, exactly. And I think, yeah, so that strength can potentially turn into a weakness, which is why I think the people he has around him as assistants will be so important. And like I said, Carosella, I think, will play the key role. You know, I can't imagine he'll go anywhere. With those strong voices and that sort of inbuilt knowledge of the list already, that, you know, Brad's not going to come in and say, okay, well, you know, clean house. And whereas when he came to North, he was 34 or 33, first time coach, and basically sort of running blind a little bit. And then, you know, the facilities had just been updated to something that was actually AFL standard compared to what it was two decades before. So for his strength not to turn into a weakness, I think with the communication and potentially the lack of flexibility, he needs those strong assistant guys around him, and people that he trusts as well, which is obviously the main thing. So I think those appointments, in a way, are almost going to be as important as Brad as head coach.
Yeah, well, we'll watch that space. I mean, and I guess another thing is that, you know, he is a second time coach. He's had a go at it before, and a fairly decent crack at it before this time. And you know, the stats have all come out that, you know, other than I think what Malthouse at Collingwood in the last 20 years or so, that's the only time where a coach has come from one club and gone to another and been successful. I guess what do you think about that? Is that something that is just because people haven't up until recently given, you know, coaches who failed a first time a second chance, and we're not, you know, now we've got Ratten at St Kilda and Voss at Carlton, you know, we might start to see that trend change? Or do you think, you know, the fresh ideas is more of the way to go?
Oh, it's an interesting one. I mean, I think it's very much a case-by-case basis. So, like, you look at someone like Ross Lyon, and since he's left Fremantle, he's really sat back in the media, and you can tell he's comfortable and he's enjoying what he does there. And so he's sort of like clockwork, his name comes up for a coaching role. But I think the way he carries himself, this could end up being egg on my face in a couple of years' time, but the way he carries himself, he doesn't look like someone who'd be able to step in as it stands right now and be a successful coach the second time around. But then, like you said, you look at Voss at Carlton, and you know, after Brisbane, he went back to, was it Port Adelaide, and did his time there. And you can see the difference he made to Carlton this year compared to how they were last year under David Teague, like night and day. It couldn't be any more of a difference if you tried. And I think for me, Scott falls in that Voss category rather than the Lyon category. I've mentioned it a few times, but I can only imagine what he would have learned every day at the AFL. I'm kind of jealous of the stats and the intel that he would have been privy to over the last 3 years. So I think from a Brad at Essendon point of view, I'm for it. I think it's a good appointment.
Yeah, as you say, I think that AFL experience and the AFL IP that he's got, I don't think no other coach is going to go into a role ever having that sort of, you know, exposure to as many different programs as he would have in his role. So, you know, I think it's really interesting to see how it's going to play out there. Moving on to Essendon's list, as we sort of said through the show today, it's a really young list. What are the sort of players that you think he's going to be able to get the most out of, basically, you know, considering the players that he developed at North Melbourne? You talked about Jacobs, you know, and giving him a role that helped make the team successful. What sort of, you know, is there a style of play you think Brad Scott's going to be really good for, or can you even pinpoint specific players you think Brad Scott's going to be able to turn this guy into a really good player?
I think I mean, working under the assumption that he'll play, you know, something similar to what he wanted to play at North, and obviously the wild card is what he's learned at the AFL. I think the key forwards are going to have a great time. For a long time, we favoured sort of three tall forwards with a style based around highlighting them. I guess for lack of a better term, it was a, I guess, a traditional forward line. If I'm sure there's a better way to describe it, with sort of standard responsibilities and sort of Petrie Waite Brown or Tarrant Hanson early on, and that constantly evolved and figured out the best way to highlight those guys. So I think someone like Peter Wright is going to have, even if his goal tally is the same next year as it was last year, even potentially a little less, I think he'll be a much more damaging and threatening player because of the way Brad's like to highlight those key forwards. And I think I'm going to talk about breakout stuff later, but I think someone like Harry Jones, if he stays fit, is going to is a strong candidate for a breakout year, because, you know, playing as that second tall alongside Wright, and whether he wants to play three or three talls and who that third tall is, I guess we'll have to wait and see. But I think Wright and Jones are going to enjoy life under Brad.
Yeah, I think when you started talking about that, I sort of drew the connection between, you know, peak Ben Brown in when he was playing for North is sort of a similar player to Wright. You know, they're more focused on leading, and obviously both really accurate kicks. So I'm assuming Brad Scott's going to look at him and go, well, I can use him in the role I use Ben Brown in. And obviously, you know, I think one of the debates at the moment with Essendon is do they play two rucks? Brad Scott a two ruck kind of guy, or was he, you know, really relying on Goldstein and someone else giving a chop out?
No, well, that's actually a part that I'm fascinated to see how he approaches, because he had the luxury of Goldie being able to play 92% game time week after week. For a couple of weeks where you'd sit there and you have a rest of like 3 minutes a game, which for a ruck is just insane. And I don't think Draper sort of tends to top out at sort of that 75% to 80% game time, which is not something Brad's had to deal with in his time as coach. So, how he does that, whether he goes, you know, Draper and Phillips or Draper and Bryan or wants maybe Wright to be the second ruck, I don't know. I'm actually really interested to see how he approaches that, because that'll be something new for him. I'm sure he's got plans, obviously, but it's a new one for him.
Yeah, I actually quite like Wright as a second ruck. I think one of the things for him is that sometimes, you know, if he's not in the game, it's a really good, you know, don't want to sound like Robert Walls, but he was on the selection panel, so maybe you put that to Brad Scott. But one of the things is, you know, when you're not getting in the game as a forward, being able to go into the ruck. And I think he's actually a pretty effective ruck. I was looking at the stats this year for centre bounce attendances, and which led to a clearance. And, you know, Wright was actually pretty effective in centre bounces that Essendon won when he was in there. And even last season, his most prolific game, the seven goals against the Western Bulldogs, he was playing a second ruck. That game is a few examples where he would ruck the centre bounce and then be able to run down and get the mark and kick the goal. So I see that as a pretty clear option potentially there if he's looking at that. And obviously, hopefully Draper, you know, over time, he'll just keep building that tank and be able to, you know, he's probably never going to get to that Goldstein role, because what Goldstein's been doing it for 12 years and he doesn't look like slowing down really, does he?
Yeah.
He's probably never going to get to that level, but, you know, if he can get to 80, 85% game time as a main ruck, then you probably can, you know, have those three tall forwards and have Wright as a secondary option or someone else there.
Well, the interesting thing about that actually is that might actually lead to more flexibility, because I mean, one of the common complaints amongst North fans at times was that because Goldie was such a behemoth in the ruck and could do it all himself every week, like sometimes you'd have Drew Petrie sort of languishing and he gave his quiet games, but he wouldn't be in the ruck, or you know, might have been someone like, you know, Ben Brown before his knees became sort of too much of a trouble. Like, yeah, it's like, well, why are they sort of, you know, languishing down forward and sort of, you know, getting frostbite? But you couldn't really do it because Goldie was the number one ruck all the time and he's not the greatest forward of all time. Whereas now with Draper, like you said, sort of, you know, whatever he can get to, like you have to play a second ruck at some stage. So you're kind of forced into that flexibility, which, I think, yeah, silver linings.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess on the flip side then, so based on the types of players that Scott preferred, is there anyone who's been a regular player for Essendon recently in the last couple of years that you think may struggle for games under a Scott game style?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think there's the sort of the wider conversation about the midfield mix and how that is fixed. and what that entails, whether it's just a simple role change or whether it's a personnel change. But I think in the big picture, I think it's genuinely going to be a clean slate, because I'm pretty convinced he's going to come in with new ideas and a new outlook, and everyone's going to start from scratch. And I guess that's the thing. It is such a young list, kind of forced to start from scratch. So I think he's kind of really building from the ground up from a style point of view.
Yeah, so I think one of the things I said mid-year is that Essendon really needs to stick with something, and I was even right at the end with Rutten, I thought he should have at least had the first half of next year to stick it out and see what happened. Obviously, the club went a different way, but we just need to have a focus and allow someone to see it to its fullest. Because if you don't, just going to keep chopping and changing, and in 3 years we're going to be in the same boat again. And I guess, just as an outsider, looking dispassionately, or I guess if you look past your rivalry, the hatred, putting on your analyst hat, obviously overall for Essendon it was a poor year, but also if you look at some of the results, they beat two of the four prelim finalists, and they were in front of the final siren against the third prelim finalist. So I guess no one's ever going to say that 2022 was a successful year for Essendon, but what's your assessment of where Essendon is at as a whole, ignoring the off-field stuff? Because I think regardless of how well Scott comes in with good ideas and how well he coaches, if they don't sort out the off-field, they're never going to be successful. So assuming that the off-field gets sorted out, what's your assessment of where Essendon is at?
So, I mean, I guess the obvious one is how young they are. I was trying to look for some sort of number to sort of reiterate how young they are, how young the list is. And I settled on, at the moment, Nick Hines, the sixth oldest player on the list, and he doesn't turn 29 until August. So I was looking at that. I'm like, oh, yeah, it's pretty young. I mean, I think overall there's been a handful of misfires with the list build around the midfield, like I mentioned. But I think from a long-term point of view, like, there's talent there which needs time. Like, like we've mentioned Jones, we've mentioned Draper, you got Cox, you got Perkins. D'Ambrosio looked good when he came in. I'm a big rap on Reed as well, and I thought he took a really nice step forward this year, and maybe he's still sort of 18 months away from being a regular best 22, but I think he's a key defender for the next, however many years. And I think that there is individual talent there, which is why, so it's not necessarily a start from scratch with that, but it is a start from scratch with the game style. So, I mean, I floated in and out of writing about it during the year, but the defense was just a little bit all over the shop. And the offense changed from week to week. Like, sometimes it was measured, sometimes it was rapid. There wasn't really a connecting line between what forced the slow stuff, what forced the fast stuff. I couldn't really figure out what they were trying to achieve on both sides of the ball, just because it was such a change. I mean, you look at, say, compare Essendon to, say, Hawthorn, similar finishing positions in the end, was what, one or two wins separating them both or whatever. But every week you could see exactly what Hawthorn were trying to do under Sam Mitchell, like the way they wanted to move the ball, the way they wanted to defend, what they were working on, their priority areas. And yeah, they only finished with 8 wins and copped a couple of big losses, but you could see exactly what they're trying to build towards. And I couldn't necessarily see that with Essendon consistently. And I think that's the area that will decide how quickly Essendon bounce back up. And whether the people in the shadows, like you mentioned, the off-field stuff, which is another probably 3 podcast episodes by itself.
we're recording this, after the glorious tenure of Andrew Thorburn. I don't even know if I said his name right, as CEO. 24 hours. It's the Grandpa Simpson gif, walking in the door, putting your hat down and leaving. So before anyone asks, I have no comment on that. I just think there's enough being said on all sides. Adding one more opinion to that is not really worth it for someone who's not going to be at the club anymore. So I'd rather just hope that they get the next one right and move on from there. But yeah, I guess... Yeah. I'm thinking more generally then. So, you probably watch as much football as anyone does.
Yeah.
Do you think you've got a sense of where the game is heading tactically in the next 5 years? For example, is the Geelong model what everyone's going to, try and strive to achieve? Or is that just sort of a one-off for, a team that's been constructed pretty specifically for that list, the core that they have. Obviously, Essendon was really trying to play that Richmond style. Is that is that Richmond style on the wane? Is there something else coming up? What's your thoughts?
So it's, I don't think teams can replicate Geelong, even if they wanted to, because Geelong have so many inbuilt advantages. One with a head start on how they manage their list, but they're not also locations and home ground. And probably I actually think they have the best home ground advantage in the league, or biggest, I should say, home ground advantage in the league compared to all the other teams. It's funny, actually, because obviously, you know, subjecting myself to North every week this year, and I just kept coming back to the conclusion that this isn't how you should be playing AFL in 2022. And then it sort of, I kept writing variations of that from week to week.
Control C, Control V, just get the thesaurus out.
That's it. And then after a few weeks of that, I kind of stepped back and realized, well, if you're going to keep writing it every week, well, then how should the AFL in 2022 be played? You know, where is it going? So I spent a lot of time this year just kind of watching and taking notes and sort of figuring out where at least I think AFL is going over the next few years. And I actually think we're heading into an offensive phase of the game. And I think Collingwood's ball movement in general play this year is that next step. And I think if we take it back to sort of Richmond's rise, I was at 6 years ago now, with that pressure game they brought in, like it's been continually improved upon by other teams. I guess West Coast were the first team to realise that kick mark could counter that effectively, measured kick mark, but then the defense evolved again, and the slow kick mark didn't have the same success as it once did, as Geelong found out for a few years in a row, getting close but not quite. And I think teams have figured out in general that more aggression on the ball movement is the way to break a defense, which is what Collingwood did so well this year at the top level, and also Hawthorn did sneakily well under the radar at a lower level, obviously. I think there's a quote from Arsene Wenger that I place a lot of stock in, even though it's for soccer. I think it applies to football when he says, football always progresses, like the attack creates a new problem and then the defense responds. And I think we're in a stage where the attack's about to create a new problem, because the attack has responded to what the defense has done over the last few years. So, I definitely think we're heading into offensive phase, and Collingwood's ball movement in general play was, I guess, the symbol of that this year. And how that evolves next year is going to be interesting to watch.
Well, I guess just sort of building on that, this is sort of a question without notice. Is there a sort of trend in terms of how long whether the offense or the defense is in ascendancy before teams work it out, or is it just pretty random depending on, you know, individual teams or individual coaches, you know, discovering something or, you know, being forced to do something that ends up working? Is there sort of a pattern to the way in which that progresses?
I feel like a lot of it depends on what rule changes the AFL decide to do.
Well, that was the next thing I was going to say, is that, you know, the rule changes, you know, affect it. And obviously, you know, maybe Brad's got an idea of what rule changes are coming next year, so he'll have an advantage there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I look at the stand rule, and I know, I doubt any Richmond fans are listening to this, but a lot of Richmond fans thought that stand rule was specifically brought in to sort of counter their main strengths. I mean, and yeah, not to get too far down the conspiracy theory hole, but in a general sense, you can see how that stand rule, I guess, took away a little bit of Richmond's strength and promoted offense. So, I mean, that's the AFL's goal. And I feel like, you know, the AFL probably, if every game was sort of 110 to 95 or 120 to 110, they'd be happy. But I think a lot of it depends on how long these things evolve for. A lot of it depends on the rule changes. And then I guess when a team does stumble onto something, like how far ahead of the pack they are. And that's why I think it's a really interesting phase now, because, I mean, I know we say this every year for the last 15, like 12 years, but I can't imagine Geelong are going to be up the top for too much longer.
I lived in Geelong when they started winning their premierships. And yeah, I just, you know, just being an Essendon, we were obviously Essendon was down at that time. So, you know, being an Essendon fan in Geelong, not fun, especially, you know, it was fun on, you know, when they won the grand final, you'd go out in town and it was packed and crazy, but, you know, other than that, you know, could do without it. So, you know, I would like to see them, you know, have a little bit of, you know, humility down the bottom of the ladder for a bit, like the rest of us plebs. But
even if they're not up the top, I mean, I'll still be a decent side, but in terms of them being in the top tier, very, very, you know, tip top tier, I don't think that's going to last too much. And I think I think probably Sydney are the next. Feels like Sydney are the next team. I'm not saying that just because they made a grand final, but in terms of their list profile. But then they have a little bit of that sort of nagging doubt that they can maybe go in their shell a little bit too much with the ball movement, like we saw in the sort of second half against last quarter and a half against Collingwood. And so there's no real clear next sort of, oh, Jesus, these guys are going to be the team for the next 4 years, you know? So I think it's, yeah, it's what makes it really interesting to see what team breaks away and how they break away in the style they play. So it's, I think it's really open.
Yeah. Well, I guess just, you know, sort of coming back to what Scott's got to look ahead of him, should he be trying to ride that trend, you know, the offensive trend, or do you think there's value in trying to be the coach that stops that before it even starts, you know, identifying that's the way the game's moving and, you know, thinking of ways to counter it? Or does it really depend on how I'm guessing you're probably going to say what I'm about to, I've just sort of come to the realization in my head, it probably depends on how he sees the list in terms of what it's capable of.
Yeah, potentially. And I mean, I know we keep coming back to it every, you know, 3-4 minutes, but like he'll have seen a lot of stuff that has never seen the light of day in terms of trends and whatnot, that, you know, probably very few people at the AFL have seen, you know, apart from him and probably the big dogs at exec level. So he might have intel that says the AFL is going in a completely different direction, and he can steal a march on the rest of the league, which is every chance. I think in a general sense, I think the midfield mix has to be overhauled somehow. And I'm pretty adamant that you can't play all of Merritt, Parrish and Shield in the on-ball rotation at the same time unless one of them change their role, because the three pure ball winners at the same time, well, man, I just don't think it works. I think that's probably his main focus from a style point of view. And then after that, that'll obviously have an impact on how you defend and how you attack, whether you can go taller, whether you can go smaller in the forward half. But yeah, I think it's definitely a blank slate for Essendon. And at a good time too, with the way I think anyway, the game's evolving.
Well, that's it. And as I said, I think, you know, your opinion is as valid as anyone's, especially considering, you know, your work on the shin bone. And can you just sort of go into, you know, just as we had to wrap this up, can you just sort of go into what you do there, you know, assuage people that it's not just, you know, entirely North Melbourne stuff, and how people can access your work and support you?
Yeah, so the shinboner.com is where everything is. So the rest of trade period, the plan is to have a post on every player who's moved clubs, with the potential exception of a couple of delisted free agents. Patreon, it's just Patreon, patreon.com/theshinboner. So get first access to those posts for 24 hours before they're opened up for the public. So that's for the next, you know, 10 days or whatever it is, even though trade period feels like about, you know, 6 weeks. And then after trade period finishes, we'll go on hiatus till March. Got my real job at Channel 7 running the cricket socials to focus on. Just for the record, I don't have any impact on what's broadcast where, so don't come at me for that. And then from March 1 next year, I'll be back in force. Patreon running again, all refreshed with a few new long-term running features I want to unwrap.
Well, look, as I said, I've started getting onto it this past couple of months, and I actually signed up this past week when you started doing the trade stuff. So I'm super impressed with the work, and I think everyone should get on and check it out. As I said, and look, you know, I know you sort of made the comment that, you know, this could be the last appearance of a non-Essendon person, but I know Jono as well is also really, you know, really impressed with the work you do. And hopefully can have you back on sometime next year, maybe as part of our preview for the next Essendon North game, and, you know, really dig down into how that game's going to go.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I'd be stunned if that wasn't around one job. It just makes too much sense, to be honest, but we'll see what happens.
We'll see. Well, that's it from us. The next planned episode will be in a couple of weeks when Jono's back overseas. So we'll be reviewing what happened during trade week for Essendon, probably leaning a lot on what Ricky posts on the Shinboner. And then we'll be looking forward to the national draft, where we have another special guest lined up for that as well. Till then, take care all, and go Dons.